ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If this thing is built, it will be a miracle to behold.
One of science's biggest promises.
It would be like the Wright brothers moment.
Governments, spies, billion-dollar investments, and scientific rivalries.
The control that's required is rivaled only by what God did in creating the universe.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Belle, a personal question. How many hours did you sleep last night?
Hard to say. I'd say between 7 and 8, but it's hard to get up during these chilly, wintry Melbourne mornings. How about you?
Just about 2 hours.
No.
And as Professor Catherine Ball writes in her new book on the future of sleep, that exchange about hours slept is a puzzle. Is it smart to get very little and just crash on, as Margaret Thatcher did, like a heroic martyr, or instead go sensibly for the healthy option and kip away soundly?
I'd just love it if my future of sleep didn't involve me waking up at 3 a.m. every day. I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams, and we shall explore the eternal sleep later in this science show in a fossil graveyard, as well as exploring the future with Professor Crystal Ball. We begin, though, with a serious and timely tribute. As mentioned on the Science Show recently, one of the greatest research leaders in the world died in April, Dame Bridget Ogilvie, and a memorial was held to celebrate her superb achievements. The tributes were just stunning. She was from Glen Innes in northern New South Wales, and that happens to be the constituency of Tim Ayres, our Federal Minister of Science. But he was not in the Institute for Innovation in Wollongong to hear the praises. However, a former Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, did speak online as the chair of the Wellcome Trust in London, which Bridget Ogilvie led. Just listen.
This year, Wellcome turns 90. It is 90 years since the death of our founder, Henry Wellcome, and the creation of the Trust. As the Board of Governors, the staff and the wider Wellcome community gather to mark this milestone, we will be thinking about the incredible contribution of Dame Bridget Ogilvie. We remember Bridget with deep affection and are profoundly grateful for her outstanding leadership as Director of Wellcome from 1991 to 1998, which was a defining era in modern science. Her most enduring institutional legacy remains her pivotal role in securing funding for the establishment of the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Hinxton, Cambridge, in 1993. Recognising the revolutionary potential of genomic medicine before it was widely accepted, Bridget championed the Institute's creation. Under her stewardship, Wellcome guaranteed the sustained backing that allowed the Sanger Institute to make the largest single contribution to the Human Genome Project, mapping 1/3 of the human genetic code and ensuring that this invaluable data remained free and publicly accessible to researchers worldwide. Bridget's foresight during the dawn of this scientific revolution ensured that the blueprint of human life was kept in the public domain, a gift to global science that continues to save lives today. Beyond genetics, Bridget dramatically expanded and strengthened Wellcome's commitment to global health. She possessed a rare holistic vision for science, understanding that medical breakthroughs are only as good as their real-world accessibility. She threw her weight behind major international research programs, particularly in Southeast Asia and Africa, focusing on malaria, tropical diseases and community-led healthcare systems. These very initiatives continue to thrive and make a tangible difference today. Bridget's amazing career took her from an Australian sheep farm to the heights of global scientific leadership, and she did this at a time when there were huge systemic barriers facing women in science. As an Australian, I am immensely proud of her. As a woman with my own experiences of leadership, I admire the way she blazed a trail for other women and the spirit in which she mentored and encouraged young scientists. Dame Bridget Ogilvie was a pioneering leader who showed what is possible when brilliance meets relentless determination. To all those gathered today and to all who loved and admired Bridget, on behalf of Wellcome and on my own behalf, I offer our most sincere condolences.
What a tribute from former Prime Minister Julia Gillard in the memorial for Dame Bridget Ogilvie just held in the Innovations Campus, University of Wollongong. Once more, evidence of an Australian scientist at the highest level of achievement. And we shall have a full science show on Dame Bridget Ogilvie in a few weeks. And so to sleep. Some of us know that too many gadgets, those screens, that light, interfere with our rest. Now the question is, does Professor Catherine Ball want more tech or less? You decide. I have just passed your bedroom, one of your bedrooms, and I expected it to look like something out of Cape Canaveral or Houston, you know, Mission Control, with those huge banks of instruments and furniture obeying, but it looked like an ordinary bedroom.
And that's what we call ambient AI, because what you didn't see en route to the study, I must say, where we're now recording this, is the Withings mat I had underneath my mattress. And of course, if I'd managed to buy one in Vegas, I would have had a smart nearable lamp from the CES, but I didn't buy one.
What's the lamp do?
So nearables are the new wearables. So these lamps coming out of Japan actually measure your respiration rate, your heart rate variability, and how much you move around, and tell you how well you're sleeping. But you don't have to wear anything. It's just watching you using a radar or a LIDAR system.
And you're comfortable with that, are you, next to you?
I would be very comfortable with that, but also particularly I would really like my mum to have one of those, because one of the things we can see the use of these in an ageing population is if someone falls over, the lamp knows you've fallen over and can send an alarm.
And a watch does that too, doesn't it?
If the watch is properly set up and you've got an expensive enough watch, yes. But you don't have to wear a watch when it's ambient. You can just walk around and not worry about whether you've charged the device or you've got it on at all. It's just everything's always watching you.
Okay, I didn't notice anything much, but what else have you got in the bedroom next door?
It has to be said, we're in a rental here, so I have not built that bedroom or sleep pod the way I would like to have it done. For example, I'd like triple glazed glass. I'd like proper full blackout blinds. My mattress is a good, expensive mattress, but I would actually like a smart mattress, which cools and heats according to your body to keep you into sleep. And also the brown noise, pink noise, white noise setup, I haven't got either. But I've got very young children, so I'm kind of in a just get everyone into bed and get to sleep type place. So my wearables don't really exist either. I don't wear a wearable. The nearables are the things that I'm relying on.
The final test, actually, before we talk gossip. I slept about 4.5 hours last night. How many did you do?
Well, let's have a look and I will tell you my exact score, but I think I hit around the 8 marker. I tend to actually do really good with deep sleep, so not all sleep is equal. So here we go. My sleep score for last night was 79, which isn't the best, but you can see I've got lots of interruptions where I was doom scrolling for the first part of the night when I should have been asleep. And I have managed about 7.5 hours worth of sleep, which is what they say is in the sweet spot. Now, bear in mind, these things are 10 to 20% erroneous. It means I could have had maybe 7 hours, maybe I had 8 hours, but as long as it's more than 4.5, I think I'm in a better position than you, Robin.
And I feel it. But you've got records like that for every night you sleep?
Yeah, and if I took the nearables with me as I travelled, I could put those into any hotel room that I'm travelling in. And in fact, in the future, hotel rooms will have the smart beds in that you'll be able to log into like you can with your iPhones or your phones or your tablets or wherever it is that you're travelling. So the bed will know your preferred sleep settings wherever you are in the world.
With an intelligent mattress?
Intelligent mattress, intelligent bed frame, intelligent room. This is the move to Industry 6.0, the rise of ambient AI.
It reminds me to some extent, if you go into a kitchen, there's a fascist fridge which orders groceries for itself without necessarily consulting you. And I am absolutely driven mad by techo everywhere. Aren't you?
There comes a point when something's useful enough, you forget about it. So for example, we set and forget things like monthly subscriptions. I know right now I need to go and buy some eggs, some bread and some milk. Wouldn't it be great if it was just already there and I didn't have to think about it and work out when I'm going to fit that in before I pick the kids up from school? Drone deliveries are something I think we should really have more of here in Australia, and they started in Queensland, in Logan, and have done very well and are now spreading out across the country. But I'm quite happy to give my fridge a budget, knowing that it'll know what I need. Now, it's not allowed to go and buy, well, maybe it can buy very expensive ice cream. I'm about to say, it's not allowed to go and buy all the sweets for the kids they might want it to buy. But to have what we know we use on a regular basis, and even to look for better deals for us. The future of marketing is actually people marketing their AI to our AI. That is the key.
What brings it to you? What fetches it?
Well, you can have lots of things. So, for example, in some parts of the world, they've got delivery robots. In some parts of the world, they have delivery drones. In some parts of the world, they're gearing up humanoid robots to do it. Like something out of that movie, iRobot, with Will Smith.
But don't you like leaving the house and going to a friendly grocer shop and asking for a pound of spinach?
This is where the utilitarian nature of this technology, rather than what allows us to have fun, is a really interesting question. So I love to go and have a good coffee and buy something from my local bakery and eat that as I go for a beautiful walk around the Sydney Harbour here in Balmain. Bliss. Do I enjoy going to a car park, parking up, trying to find a car park, finding a basket, bashing into people, people looking at things, looking for deals, very hyper-stimulated under great fluorescent lights, trying to find a good deal, trying to find the right stuff I want inside a supermarket? No, that's kind of like, you know, how you go into some hardware shops, I won't name them, but you know, you get lost in the map and you could probably live in there for a couple of days before someone picks up that you were in there at all. I'd sooner allow the robotics to do the mundane and allow me to enjoy the bliss moments. Does that sound too utopian for you, Robin?
Not too utopian, too bloody expensive, and too much energy with all these devices zooming around, cluttering up the horizon.
Well, if you think about it, it's just going to replace other types of vehicles. We don't have exposure here in Australia to a lot of other kind of vehicles. So when I was at the University of Utah, I saw this little delivery robot on the path, and it was really cute, and it knew where it went, and it went on a path, and it had a designated place, and off it went delivering Mexican food to some hungover students somewhere. In the US, we've got things like, you know, the Waymos, the Teslas, the Zooxes, all of these autonomous vehicles, and they will be doing lots of delivering. And the thing will be, even if we have autonomous buses, it doesn't mean we won't have a bus driver per se, but the bus driver won't be driving necessarily. They'll be there for social interaction, helping the local community, being there for a safety measure, not having to worry about swerving around on the roads. One of the things about writing this book that really shocked me, one of the statistics that really got me, was our lack of automation and AI inside how we drive our cars, in that if you combine the number of deaths on the road from drugs and from alcohol, and you combine those together, the number of deaths from fatigue is bigger than that. And yet we worry all the time about drug driving and drink driving, but we don't really worry about fatigue driving. So when you say, oh, do we want to have all these things, you know, blocking and delivering and stuff, I would sooner have a hungover person ordering food in through a delivery robot or a delivery human than getting in their car and driving and potentially having an accident. So I think social license will start switching to more autonomous systems as we see the use cases scale globally.
As you, much to my surprise, apply this, as in your book, when I finished reading your book, I thought you were trying to defend us from too much gear, too much tech.
Yeah. Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you do the natural sleep with that sort of assistance from the techo, how do you feel?
We have something that's a bit of a shadow pandemic in this country, which is our mental health in this country at the moment. And the Black Dog Institute, who are experts in this matter and who I'd refer everyone to go and have a look at this research, found that in our adolescence, particularly, the mental health crisis is actually a sleep crisis. So one of the things that you see all of these sort of fitness and health and wellness people and influencers and stuff like that, even medical advisors, if you could just have a few good nights sleep, the world will look and feel like a better place. You'll also make better food choices. You'll also have the energy to exercise. You'll actually feel better in yourself. And recently I challenged an audience to say, do you think you could do 8 nights of 8 hours sleep? And everyone took a gasp. Mm-hmm. And then for the women, could you do 9 or 10 hours a night? For 9 or 10 nights, and they looked at me like I was speaking Latin. This is our biology. And since we've had gas lamps and electrical lights, our biology has been turned into a money-making opportunity for corporates. We no longer live according to our biology in many ways, but one of the things technology can do is save our sleep.
And when it's saving our sleep, does it make you naturally revert to the two sleep nights? In other words, you wake up after 3 or 4 hours. Most of us who have that experience just give up at that point, but you're supposed to just get up and do something else and then go for another sleep afterwards, number two.
Well, this is the history side of things, right? So if you are a person listening to this and you are one of these people that does a double sleep, you have been written about by authors and poets for centuries. I think Chaucer even refers to it. I don't have two sleeps. I have two small children, which means I have about 6 or 8 sleeps. And when they're newborn, you probably have about 10 or 12 micro sleeps. And the point is, you need to sleep enough so that you feel rested. And actually, the biggest key here is routine. So even if you wake up after 3 or 4 hours, build the routine of going, you know what, I'm obviously a double sleeper. Chaucer wrote about people like me. It's all right. I can go back to sleep now. It's not a point of stress. Whereas if you wake up and start getting anxious about your sleep, well, that's a whole new thing called orthosomnia, which is a type of anxiety formed around people worrying about their sleep so much that they then actually don't get the sleep that they need.
Well, I don't. And as we're alone, I will confess, the thing that worries me in this complicated world full of war, full of turmoil, is being worried about which blockages I will face the next day. What won't work? What's been closed down? What's been cancelled? All those sorts of things. And you can call it anxiety. It's also preparation, because Bob Ellis, the writer, once wrote about night thoughts. Mm-hmm. They hover, they don't go away, and round and round and round you go. Do you know what I mean?
We have apps for that now. So there's a really great one that's come out of the US called Nightwear, which has been developed for people who were coming out of the military who had post-traumatic stress disorder. So obviously there's natural language processing work that a counsellor or psychologist can do if you're having these kinds of anxious thoughts at night. And that's involving neuro-linguistic programming and CBT. So you're actually reframing this inside your neurobiology and using neuroplasticity. So resetting the frameworks in your brain about the things that might be bothering you. And now people have realized they can actually train you in an app to forget some of these things. And now they're looking at different ways of wearables to help you switch off and actually switch on your parasympathetic nervous system, your rest and digest nervous system, and switch down that cortisol, anxious, sympathetic nervous system that we all ride, like the horse that is the nightmare that we ride.
As is the cost of it all with tech. First thing that happens in the morning, most of us have to open our machine with a screen, and there are all the messages pouring in from people you've never met, most of which you've never heard of. And just sorting that kind of life with tech everywhere not only takes so much time, but it costs a fortune.
Well, again, we've got solutions for this. So having your own IT or technical hygiene is up to you. You decide where you charge your devices. You decide what time you switch them on. You, for example, could have an AI agent replying to a lot of those emails for you, or even filtering those emails for you, Robin, so you never even have to see them. You could also put an out-of-office response on and say, sorry, I'm not answering emails for the next 6 months, and see where people move to. There's been books written about this on how to dial down the unnecessary double or triple handling we do of things like emails and messages. And so the answer really is literally in the palm of your hand. How you choose to use these technologies. And it's interesting, as a mother of two kids, my kids watch how I use these technologies. And when I see my child say, Mum, put your phone down, it's a bit of a shock and a bit of a mirror to me. And so I have started learning to close the doors on my study and walk away from the screens that are trying to talk to me and be more mindfully present with my family. And it's not easy, because these things are so addictive, but it can be done. We just have to keep going and build the routines and build our lives the way we want them to. Since when did our iPhones or our technological devices dictate our lives? Since when? When do we allow that to happen?
They're doing it all the time.
Only because you switch them on, Robin.
I don't switch them on. I refuse to have them most of the time.
I was going to say, where's your block of wood that you call your iPhone that you normally have as a little touchstone in your pocket?
Indeed. I wish you luck with the book. And you say in the beginning, it's not a medical book. It's not a piece of advice on how to look after your health. It's a look at the future. Is that really why you wrote the book?
I have got this idea that we need to talk about science and technology and the good things that these can do. We have a problem with science communication in that we don't have like a Kim Kardashian-esque person that is telling our stories for us and getting the zeitgeist and getting the salience around people's buy-in and listening. So I am trying as an individual scientist and independent science communicator to engage people on any level about all of the technologies that could potentially make their lives happier, healthier, have a better health span, have more fun with their lives, and recognize that the technologies that you have in your hand can actually make your life better, and you don't have to be a slave to them. You don't have to worry about your scores. You don't have to worry about filling rings or filling completions or runs on software apps. Use them how you want to use them. Don't be used by them, and just be mindful. And this book is the first of a sort of approach of mine as an independent publisher now to try and get more people talking about science and reading about science just in any way, shape or form. So I thought everyone sleeps, so let's start with sleep. We've got a sleep crisis, we've got a technological capability, we've got the ability for people to engage with these technologies at a low cost entry. Why aren't we all using them for the betterment of our sleep, which means the betterment of our health and our happiness? And so I hope this book brings you all joy and an opportunity to learn something new about the technology around you and steer it for good.
Brought me joy. Thank you, Crystal.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, some of her friends do call her Crystal, as she's a futurist, after all. Professor Catherine Ball now in Singapore. And so, as promised, we go to that long final sleep in this somnolent science show. Belle Smith.
A few weeks ago, scientists announced they'd found a gigantic graveyard of sorts off the coast of Western Australia, a whale necropolis 7 kilometres below the waves and extending 1,200 kilometres along a trench in the seafloor. Amazing. Some of these bones in the graveyard belong to whales that patrolled the ocean more than 5 million years ago. You can find the full story on Lamp Notes on ABC Listen. But this story got me thinking, what other mass fossil graveyards are out there? And what can they tell us about life on Earth thousands or even millions of years ago? One place that holds an extraordinary number of dinosaur fossils is Pipestone Creek in Canada. But how all those dinos ended up there is extraordinary too. This is Dr. Emily Bamforth, paleontologist and curator at the Philip J. Curry Dinosaur Museum in Alberta.
So the Pipestone Creek bone bed is one of the largest and densest dinosaur deposits in North America, if not the entire world. For about 90% of the material in this bone bed belongs to one species of dinosaur. It's a dinosaur called Pachyrhinosaurus. And these animals died in a mass death event. So we believe that they were traveling in a herd, potentially a herd of up to 10,000 animals. And then one terrible day for them, something happened that wiped out, if not this entire herd, then a good portion of it. And this is where they were buried. And of course, where they eventually were preserved and fossilized for us to find. And so it's partly the sheer density of fossils at this site. So we're looking at something like 100 to 300 bones per square meter at this one site. But it's also the scale of the bone bed. The bone bed is about a square kilometer in size. It's the estimated size. And so it is really remarkable for its size and its density, and for also the fact that it preserves a dinosaur found here and nowhere else in the world.
That's amazing. So Pachyrhinosaurus, what do we know about them?
The name actually is Latin. It means thick-nosed lizard. And they are ceratopsians or horned dinosaurs. So related to something like a triceratops, but not quite as big. The thing that makes Pachyrhinosaurus unique is instead of having a horn on their nose, like most ceratopsians do, they have a huge bony protuberance that we call a boss.
A boss?
A boss, that's right. Obviously, it's the eponymous feature, what gave Pachyrhinosaurus its name, but it's also something that these horned dinosaurs have that no other horned dinosaurs do.
I don't know if you can even estimate this, but how many individuals were buried?
What we have at Pipestone Creek is actually not skeletons. We call it our Pachyrhinosaurus omelet. So it's a huge jumble of bone. And so to get a minimum number of animals, we use what's called a minimum number of individuals. So we pick a bone that animals only have one of. So for example, a left upper arm bone or a jawbone. The minimum number we have is 48, but we suspect we have hundreds. And in the entire bone bed, if we extrapolate the size of the bone bed to what we've excavated so far, we think this herd could have had up to 10,000 animals in it.
Wow. Okay, so the bones aren't just neatly laid out in little individual animals. They're just kind of all jumbled up together. So can you reconstruct individuals, and how do you know which bones belong to which? animal.
The Pipestone bone bed has produced so much pachyrhinosaur material that we more or less have every single bone of a pachyrhinosaur. And we can look at other horned dinosaurs that have similar skeletons, and that's sort of how we know how these bones go together. Interestingly, though, we have adult skulls, we have sort of sub-adult juvenile skulls, but we don't have any skulls of the really little babies. Because dinosaurs are sort of like humans, their skulls don't fuse when they're really young. So the baby skulls fall apart. So we have bits and pieces of the baby skulls, but not a complete one.
So what can you tell about the living animal from all these remains?
One of the unique things about Pachyrhinosaur is that we have a huge sample size of a single species of dinosaur from a snapshot in geologic time. This very, very rarely happens. It's like we went back in a time machine, we opened the door on the late Cretaceous and we're looking at that herd. So we can study things like what the adults look like, what the juveniles look like, what the babies look like, and we can establish a growth series. So we understand what they look like when they were babies and what they look like when they were adults and how they changed over time. Which seems pretty standard if you think of a modern animal, but it's actually very difficult to do for a group of animals that really have no modern equivalent. We get a good sense of what's called individual variation. So what makes one dinosaur of a species different from a dinosaur of the same species, which again is something we can really rarely do in the fossil record. So for example, Pachyrhinosaurus has got horns on the edge of its frill. And we know from Pipestone Creek that they vary a lot from individual to individual. So this is what really makes Pipestone Creek paleontological gold.
So let's get to why there's a bone bed there in the first place. What happened to these creatures?
We believe that these animals were on a seasonal migration. It's speculation, but we think that these pachyrhinosaurs may have lived in dispersed herds for most of the year, and they came together to form a mega herd to migrate. So similar to something that caribou do today. And our leading hypothesis right now was that these animals died in a flash flood. So if there was a storm in the mountains, for example, that water would have fallen in the mountains, rushed down onto this coastal lowland, basically filled all the rivers and the streams. The pachyrhinosaurs, there was a huge density of them. They weren't able to get out of the way. They were probably moving through an area of lower elevation. So they would have panicked. There would have been a stampede. And unfortunately for the dinosaurs, most of them would have drowned. I said unfortunately for the dinosaurs because it was actually really good for us. But because now, of course, we study them.
What else points to this flash flood hypothesis?
So the rocks themselves indicate that this was an area that was very warm and very wet. Some of the plant fossils from the region, for example, point to an environment that was almost like a cloud forest, like almost like a rainforest. So really, really wet, sort of an environment that you would equate to somewhere on the coast today. The rocks themselves are fluvial deposits. They're deposits that were formed in rivers. Also mixed in with the Pachyrhinosaurs, there's these big coalified logs. So we know that whatever deposited the dinosaurs was carrying big chunks of vegetation with it, similar to what we would expect from a flood today.
What's a question that you haven't yet answered about Pachyrhinosaurus, but you really, really want to?
We don't understand sexual dimorphism in this animal. So what makes the males different from the females, or if there is even a feature that does? We know we have individuals that vary in appearance. So for example, some have got really big bosses, some have got really small ones, some have got huge long horns on their frills, some have got really little ones. But in dinosaurs, which laid eggs, there is very little in terms of an osteological signature, basically a signature in the bone that will tell males from females. So I think because we have such a huge sample size at Pipestone Creek, it's one of our best places to kind of pin down what sexual dimorphism in horned dinosaurs looks like. Again, that's not something that's well known pretty much anywhere in the world.
What would be an osteological difference between males and females in like a different species?
Mammals are easy because we give birth to live young. So the females and the males have got different pelvic structures. Something like dinosaurs and birds actually as well. Skeletally, males and females are very similar to each other.
I guess all the egg-laying gear is soft tissue, right?
Yes, exactly. So dinosaurs had a cloaca like a bird, like sort of a common opening where sort of everything came out. The one dead ringer for a female dinosaur is a special deposit of bone called medullary bone. This is something the birds do as well. So birds that are about to lay eggs, what we call gravid females, will have an extra layer of calcium in their bone that they use to make the eggshells. So that has been found in maybe three dinosaurs ever. And so those individuals that medullary bone is found in for sure are females. But your chance of finding a gravid female that has that are pretty rare, again, in the fossil record.
So the calcium store, I mean, it makes perfect sense. Like, where else are you going to store calcium? But the fact that you can see it in the bones all those years later, that's astounding.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So, I mean, that is potentially one thing that we could do eventually at Pipestone Creek, is to do the histology. So basically study the bone and see if any of our bones have got medullary bone. But again, that would tell us that that limb bone or that hand bone, that vertebra, belonged to a female. But it's not linked to the skull, which would be unfortunate, because the skull is kind of where we would see that variation, most likely.
Dr. Emily Bamforth, museum curator at the Philip J. Curry Dinosaur Museum in Alberta, Canada. Pipestone Creek captures one moment in time, but other fossil archives tell stories that span hundreds of thousands of years. At the Narracourt Caves in South Australia, paleontologists like Dr. Liz Reed from Adelaide University have built up a picture of how local plants, animals, and climate have changed over 500,000 years and continue to change today. And a particularly rich source of data is in the form of pitfall traps. These are caves that have an opening to the surface.
They're literally a trap lying in wait, and anything that's going too fast or not looking where it's going, or they fall into a cave, the remains do get concentrated. So we do end up with this sort of underground graveyard.
When you go into these underground graveyards, what do you see? In my mind, I think of like a cartoon where it's just like a big pyramid of stuff in the middle. But I don't know, is that what you see?
It's like a mountain of bones.
Yeah, exactly right, with a skull sitting on top.
Yeah. Well, between the time that an animal falls into a cave and decomposes, skeletonizes, there's a lot of geological time between then and when we see it. The best analogy I can give is an hourglass. If you pour sand down an hourglass, God, that sounds like a bad soap opera, doesn't it? But if you pour sand down, you get this cone forming underneath, and we get the same thing with sediments forming a cone, and that gets redistributed by water and other things. Funnily enough, though, if we come into a cave like that, what we'd see would be generally at Narracourt, red dirt, and you would see across, scattered across that, hints of remains, of skulls. It's really exciting to see the skull with the teeth upright. Your sort of torch can catch a glint of enamel, and you know that there's something, you know, there's a skull there. But one of the things that we have to recognize is that the particular accumulation modes, these things can bias the record. And by that I mean that if there are some animals that would not fall into a cave by the way they behave, they're not on the ground long enough, you know, they're not going to be susceptible to pitfall entrapment. And in the case of Narracourt, the hands-down world champions are kangaroos. And if you think about that, it makes sense. They're numerous on the landscape. They're generally fast-moving. They're active in the sort of twilight to dark. Like a lot of marsupials, they will not see the hole until it's too late, and then down they go into the cave. If you're looking at other continents, you might see things like sheep or goats or deer, you know, things that are moving around quickly and falling into caves.
Do you see the big, ancient, now extinct kangaroos, like, you know, Procoptodon and those kinds of species?
Absolutely. And we do see some of the really big megafauna, such as Diprotodon and Sargamaturus, the sort of half-ton marsupial browser. The interesting thing about those that we find at Narracourt is usually they're represented by not completely grown adults, because the adults probably aren't going to fit down some of these holes. Most of the holes are well and truly less than a meter in diameter. They're quite narrow. So there's a body size filtering effect.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
Narracourt caves aren't just full of bones of animals that fell or wandered in and died. They also contain bones and other remains that were brought in by owls.
Yeah, I'm very grateful to them because they're a great source of information, and several species are well known to use caves. So when an owl hunts, it'll grab some prey and it'll swallow that. They come back, and what they do is produce a pellet that is all of the indigestible bits, like the hair and the bones, and they literally cough that up.
And so are there old fossilised pellets that you can find in the caves?
Absolutely.
Huh.
The pellet itself has hair and other sort of soft things that sort of hold it together. And over time, it'll just sort of start to break down. So generally, by the time you get hundreds of thousands of years down the track, you've got the bones themselves, the actual bones. And you can also tell a bit about whether it's owls because of the composition of the bones. we talked a bit about accumulation modes can be biased. If I was to come in without the knowledge of our pellets and look at a fossil deposit that had been just accumulated by ours, I might conclude, 100,000 years ago, the world was run by small mammals. There was no other big animals. Well, it's not quite true because they're hunting to their prey range. So we have to understand what they're going to get us, tend to, get small to medium-sized animals, particularly mammals.
So what can our pellets tell you that other sort of big fossil deposits perhaps can't?
From a point of view of biological surveying, the owls are kind of doing that for us. They're surveying what's abundant in the landscape and collecting that. And that can change over time because the abundances of those animals changes over time as well. So they do give us a really precise window on fauna change, and particularly the smaller vertebrates. While the big ones are very exciting, we always love to find megafauna. If we've only got two diprotodon in our deposit, but we've got 40,000 rodents, the 40,000 rodents are going to tell us a lot more about the past environment. And today, biological surveyors use our pellets, use modern pellets to work out the range of small mammals, for example.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be like a little snapshot of what was scurrying around at that time. And then you can see how populations have grown or shrunk or moved, and pair that with, say, maybe climactic changes or changes in predators or whatever to build up that bigger story about what was going on over the past however many thousands of years.
Absolutely. And that they can also reveal some rather uncomfortable truths. Yeah, one of the things about these bone deposits is they do tell us a lot about the past before there was any destruction of the habitats or extinction of species, as happened in recent times since European colonization. And one really poignant example is from the Nullarbor, where we see modern owl pellets. Now, if you see some barn owl pellets that have just been dropped, they only contain house mice now, whereas even 40, 50 years ago, there were still other small mammals. The youngest dated deposit we have at Narracourt is only about 280 years. That's just prior to European colonisation. And they go back 500,000. So you think about how many major climate shifts and changes, ice ages, glacials to interglacials over that time. And the whole time the caves have been sitting there recording like an underground archive. So how can we put that to work? And one of the key things we're really interested in now is it's not just extinct animals in the deposits. A lot of the species are either still around today or became extinct very soon after colonization. So we have this archive of threatened species, and we can look at those records and project forward if we understand what drove particular organisms to extinction in the past. It can help us save threatened species today and understand how they might respond to climate change in the future.
Dr. Liz Reed, vertebrate paleontologist at Adelaide University. And Robin, Liz told me how researchers like her can tell if a bone that they've found in a cave was once part of an owl pellet. So, say an owl eats a mouse. The acids and enzymes in the owl stomach break down the mouse meat, but they also corrode the bones a little. And it's these corrosion patterns that tell scientists like Liz that the animal, the bone, had been eaten by an owl. And in some cases, the scientists can identify the species of the owl that ate it based on these corrosion patterns.
Thanks, Belle. All of which brings us to slime. Did you know that scientists across America are using AI, what else, and quantum computers to investigate snot? Well, of course they're not, but instead, this is really inspiring. A former philosopher at Caltech is doing so. Meet Sujit Dada.
You started off as a physicist, is that right?
And I'm still a physicist.
But you're working with biology and animals.
It's true. That's the beauty of physics. Physics is one of my intellectual idols, John Hopfield once said. Physics is a way of thinking, and I certainly subscribe to that. I think physics provides us with a powerful set of tools and perspectives and ways of approaching problems, And I, in my work, I apply that across domains to biology.
That sounds very exciting, but you talk about your domains. Mm-hmm. What took you then to looking at bacteria in mucus?
Yeah, it's been a circuitous trajectory. In college, I started wanting to do philosophy, and I somehow stumbled into physics. I was working on quantum physics problems, and so these days what I work on is studying how things move at microscopic scales in complex environments. And so with bacteria, for example, which is one of the big things my lab works on, typically in microbiology labs, what we do when we study bacteria is we study them in liquid cultures or on flat agar plates. And that's really powerful, and that's given us tremendous insights. But most bacteria don't live in bulk homogeneous liquids or on surfaces. They live in the porous, complex tissues and gels in our bodies. They live in mucus where they can cause infections, and they can do good things and they can do bad things. And so one of the things that we got really interested in is just trying to understand better how the molecular interactions between the molecules in mucus that make mucus slimy and snotty, how those interactions influence how bacteria grow. And we studied that using tools and approaches from physics.
Mucus is sticky enough anyway, if it's in your handkerchief and if you've got a cold. But if you're a tiny creature, it's like being somehow enveloped in deep, sticky sludge.
Exactly. And so actually, you know, what makes mucus so goopy and so on is the fact that it's made up of polymers. So polymers, they're these little microscopic molecules that are essentially like molecular spaghetti, long molecular strands that can entangle with each other. And when they do, that's what causes mucus to become thick and slimy. Respiratory conditions like cystic fibrosis, where the mucus gets thicker because those polymers are more concentrated. It's harder to hydrate that mucus. And that has really important implications for your health. People with these conditions often are prone to having more lung infections. And so that's part of what drew me to that area. We know that there are these important medical issues associated with the interactions between these molecules that make up our mucus and the bacteria that live in our mucus. But how and what do they do?
Indeed, and I'll come back to what you may have discovered. But what about cholera? A very dangerous disease.
Yeah, that's a gut pathogen. That's one of the microbes that we study in our lab. There are these bacteria that are prone to forming what are called biofilms. And that's part of what makes them so tough to treat. That's part of what makes them infectious. Biofilms are these things where the bacteria huddle together, they form little groups, and they actually secrete their own polymers, like mucus, that act like glue to hold them together, to prevent therapeutics from getting in and killing them. And so one of the things that I keep learning in what I do is how fascinating nature is. And even things like bacteria, which are arguably the simplest, most primitive form of life, can do such fascinating things by harnessing physics and chemistry. And so that's part of what we're trying to disentangle, pun intended.
Indeed. When you have disentangled, are there a couple of examples you give me that you can bring some good news about a bad circumstance to one of your colleagues, say in medicine, about how you can alleviate discomfort or the treatment of a disease as a result of your understanding of the physics of these creatures' lives?
Absolutely. And so I'll give you two quick examples. What we do is very much at the basic science end of things, but our hope is that things that we discover will eventually help guide practitioners, medical doctors, so translational researchers, to actually figure out interventions that use our discoveries to make positive impacts on people's lives. And so what we did is we designed experiments where we're actually able to use a microscope to watch individual bacterial cells in mucus as they grow and divide. And what we found was really surprising. Well, when the mucus was thicker, more concentrated, as in many of these respiratory disorders, the bacteria, instead of just growing randomly as they usually do, they seemed to form these interesting clusters. They stuck together and they formed these clusters. We call them cables because they grow as these elongated structures that look like phone cables. And that was really interesting. And because we come at these problems from using the tools and perspectives of physics and chemistry, we were able to actually use theories from physics to make predictions about when that will happen, under what conditions, for example, for a given microbe and a given composition of mucus, when that weird kind of clustered growth would happen. And now we can actually quantitatively predict that. And so because we have this understanding of when these weird growth patterns emerge in mucus, now you can start to think about, okay, what are ways I can, for example, modify that mucus by delivering enzymes to alter its molecular properties to shift yourself from being in the regime where bacteria will grow in these weird ways to more normal growth. And our discovery, I think, sets a foundation where we can start thinking about these problems in a quantitative way, framing hypotheses that researchers can keep testing and building off of. And so that's just one example of something that gives hope to people who suffer from these conditions.
An example of the same sort of work that goes on, or went on, quite recently, actually, in Queensland University of Technology, where a woman studying aspects of COVID was trying to work out the physics of where this germ lived, because everybody was saying it's on surfaces, and so you wash your hands, you don't touch the surface of this, that, and the other. And she said, "No, hang on, it's in the air." And she did the experiments to show this, mm-hmm. and that completely transformed the way COVID was treated mm-hmm. around the world.
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's a beautiful example of how ultimately we're guided by curiosity, and we're curious about the way the world works around us. But driven by that curiosity, we tried to design very careful experiments, very careful theoretical models. And just like you mentioned, the discoveries that are made in this context, it changes how people think about something entirely that then helps guide, okay, how do we treat this now? Now that we know that COVID is transmitted through aerosols, that now opens up ways to try to treat it. And so I think that's a beautiful example of what we're all trying to do ultimately.
I can understand why you said in the beginning that you're also a philosopher, because you just demonstrated that. And I just wondered how that affects the way you as a professor are teaching people in this great campus, Caltech, where you're trying to say to people, you want to be a physicist, you want to be a biologist, and you're doing all of these things because you're looking at natural history, which is a unified situation. So you got to be flexible. Is that what you're teaching them?
Absolutely. And ultimately, when I teach my students, and I love teaching, the goal is not to just deliver information. Anyone can do that. ChatGPT can do that. I'm not just trying to deliver information to them that they memorize and they repeat back and so on. But what we're trying to do is teach our students how to think about problems, how to make sense of complex data sets, figure out ways to formulate the right question and formulate ways to think about complex problems. And so ultimately, I see our primary goal is to teach our students how to think. You mentioned philosophy. You know, what drew me to philosophy is it's a way of trying to make sense of the world we live in and how we think about it. And what I do now is just a continuation of that entire endeavor. And that's, I think, what we're all trying to do is just make sense of the world around us in systematic, rigorous, quantitative ways.
And to use all aspects of science if it turns out to be relevant. Final question. On your board, you've got wonderful pictures drawn by your daughter. Mm-hmm. What do you tell your daughter, who can draw, actually, I'm looking at an anglefish and a snail, and also, what do you tell her about what daddy does?
Well, you know, I tell her that Her dad studies how things move at microscopic scales in various contexts. She's very well aware of the bacterial work. She comes to my lab every so often. She has independently developed a deep interest and curiosity in marine life. And she walks around telling people that when she grows up, she wants to be a marine biologist and discover new microbes in the ocean. So stay tuned. Hopefully you'll be interviewing her in 20 years or so.
That's a date. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
See you then. Sujit Dada, professor at Caltech. And next week in The Science Show, we'll have a couple of top scientists who also have fascinatingly varied career paths, with that variety being the secret of their success. Meanwhile, my own inspiration as a science reporter, as you may have noticed, has been Elvis. Yes, Elvis Presley. He left the building, and so do I. For example, there's an incident in Professor Lawrence's lab in Cairns. Do you remember? As I noticed something on his office wall. Talking about mammals, there's a picture on your wall of what looks like, is it an albino possum or some very white furred possum? Where'd it come from?
This comes from far north Queensland, just a little bit north of here, about an hour north of here, and it only lives on a couple of mountains above 1,100 meters elevation. So it's a high elevation specialist, and it's a really extraordinary animal in that about a third of the individuals are this beautiful, pristine white animal. The other two-thirds, and they interbreed and everything, they're the same species, are dark chocolatey brown. And in fact, there's another population of the same species, but that other population, the individuals are, white individuals are about 1 out of 1,000 or 1 out of 500. So it's really strange. What's going on in this misty mountain refuge that's been there for millions of years, and there's just these strange creatures living up there, and they're just ghostly white.
They should be all beige.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I just tell you, they are honestly one of the prettiest creatures I've ever seen. That photo that you can see right there, a friend of mine and another fellow actually caught that animal, and they got a hairbrush and they brushed it out. They're quite placid animals, and they brushed it and then they put it on a limb and took his photo, and they did a beautiful job. You have to say it's a wonderful creature.
Professor Bill Lawrence at his lab at the James Cook University in Cairns. And the further explanation about this exquisite creature is instructive. It is particularly vulnerable to climate change, he tells me. And we'll have an article from him, plus pictures of this lemuroid ringtail possum. Do look on the Science Show website. Who'd have thought? Another revelation up in the native forests of far northern Queensland. For some reason, just like polar bears, writes Professor Lawrence, these white animals are very sensitive to extreme temperature change, and that's what's happening more and more where they try to survive. Another possible victim of our new climate.
Next week on The Science Show, the dangers of mirror life. Now, I'm not talking about the glass on your bathroom wall, but a theoretical type of synthetic bacteria which worries even the scientists working on it.
And we'll have some of those once unusual careers, now more common, and more on Snow Lab, 2 kilometres underground, and what it's like to work down there in search for the missing universe. I'm Robin Williams, emulating Elvis.
That's why you dressed up in a white spangly jumpsuit, okay. I'm Belinda Smith, emulating a neutrino. I'm zooming out of here. Until next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.